It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If it's convenient and you're not driving, I want to have you take a debit card out of your wallet. Now, turn it over and look at the lower left-hand corner. What do you see? That is a Shazam bolt. A Shazam bolt. Shazam is 40 years old. Shazam heralded in an era when we can access cash pretty much anytime, anywhere. Before that, before the days of plentiful ATMs, well, of course, you had to plan trips to the bank. You had to interact with a teller, a real live person, to get your money. This hour, we want to talk about payments, how our ideas about money are changing, how the way we pay has been transformed by new technology, and how it's likely to change in the future. We want to have you join in our conversation. Have you adopted one of the newest methods of payment? Google Wallet, Apple Pay, perhaps? Have you had any bad experiences with one of the new forms of payment? Tell us about it. Are you wary or completely comfortable with a new form of payment? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Once again, our phone, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Joining us for the entire hour, first of all, Terry Dooley is with us, Executive Vice President and Chief Information Officer for Shazam. He's been with the company for over a quarter of a century. He's now in our Des Moines studio. Terry Dooley, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's on the back of our ATM cards, as I just indicated, that little lightning bolt through a letter S. What is it? How does it work?
Well, you know, your card is associated to your bank account, and when you go to an ATM or a point of sale in a merchant location to buy goods or services or access cash, we take that transaction, send it to your financial institution, or determine whether or not you have the funds in your account and approve that transaction and provide you with either cash or the goods and services that you're trying to purchase.
Mm-hmm. And that happens within a few seconds over a network.
General response time is sub-second back to the terminals.
Mm-hmm. Explain the origins of Shazam. It was established in 1976. What was going on there that heralded in this network?
Back in the mid-70s, you started to see ATMs pop up within financial institutions. Those ATMs, for the most part, were limited to just the customers of the financial institutions. And from a community bank perspective, they got together, talked about the need to allow any Iowan access to their funds, incorporated a company known at that time as the Iowa Transfer System in 1976. And that was really the initial formation of what we know today as Shazam. Began the effort to work to build the network and the infrastructure for the community banks, and we processed our first transaction on February 14th, 1977, with Des Moines National Bank.
Mm-hmm. So how large is this network?
Today, Shazam provides financial services to about 1,200 institutions in 38 states. We process in excess of a billion transactions every year. And we route and process transactions throughout the entire country.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if it was apparent then that it would take hold, or was it kind of a venture, an experiment, and cross your fingers, let's see if people like this?
I would say it was a vision of where it was going to go back 40 years ago, and you know, a very visionary, you know, view of consumers are going to need access as they travel anywhere, anytime. They're going to want the availability of the funds. So the philosophical views that started the organization back 40 years ago continue to be the views of the organization, and we continue to focus on providing community institutions access to payments.
Mm-hmm. How does Shazam make a profit? Who pays for it? How?
Shazam makes a profit. The financial institutions and or the merchants, you know, are where we generate, you know, a portion of our revenue, as well as other products and services such as mobile applications, different services, maybe marketing services, professional services to financial institutions. But we make a couple of pennies on every single transaction that we process through the network. the financial institutions enable that capability by issuing the cards out to their consumers, and then as consumers use those cards, we route and process and are able to reinvest back into our capabilities for those institutions.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about pennies being made on the transaction, does Shazam have any part to play in these surcharges for ATM withdrawals? And I have to say, of course, they're universally detested, right?
They are universally detested, and I think in Iowa we have probably one of the strongest detests for surcharge anywhere in the nation. You're probably familiar with a network and a logo referred to as Privilege Status. That is a surcharge-free network that Shazam provides its participants in the state of Iowa, and all consumers that have a Shazam card can go to those terminals and access their cash without surcharges. In response to your question, Shazam does not make anything off surcharge. That is either at the terminal or merchant location and or the financial institution. Mm-hmm. So that's strictly a pass-through through Shazam. We don't have any part in that other than enabling the service.
Terry Dooley is Executive Vice President and Chief Information Officer for Shazam. Shazam celebrating 40 years since it was came into existence in the mid-1970s. Join us with your experience. Perhaps you have an ATM experience or an experience with a new form of payment. That's what we're talking about this hour, the past, present, and future of paying for things. 1-866-780-9100. Tony Townsend is with us as well. Tony is Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at Iowa State University's College of Business in our Ames studio. Tony, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we got a little snippet of a very recent chapter in paying for things when we had the dawn of getting cash anywhere, anytime. Give us a little short history of money and the evolution of payment, if you could, to kind of give this a larger context.
Well, when I was a boy, we exchanged stones and clamshells, but it's not popular anymore.
Hard to get out of ATM machines. Not flat enough either, right?
It is, yeah. The payment systems have been around forever, and it's usually based upon, fundamentally, it's always based upon some system of perceived value of the exchange. If you go back far enough, you begin to avoid barter and you begin to exchange things that not only can I exchange with you, but I can exchange with somebody else, and they'll find value there too. So the rise of things like gold and silver, jewels, that kind of stuff that have a transportable value. And so it evolves from that into systems that represent the power of the state. So if you go back to ancient times, they had coins with the ruler's, picture on them and stuff like that, because it reinforced the nature of the state, and those became exchangeable with value, sometimes because of the metal in the coin, sometimes because of just general agreement that we're going to exchange the ducats or whatever of the state. And then it evolves eventually into later periods with trying to find something a little bit more transportable. The Chinese were big on that way, way back, and I was just reading up on this because I wasn't sure where this started. And apparently Marco Polo brought paper money sort of back to Europe in the form of guarantee notes issued by various banking institutions so that travelers could carry something of value that didn't have to be piles of gold. It could be an instrument that would represent piles of gold. And then it goes on and on like that until eventually you get the large banks in a variety of Western countries begin issuing bank notes. Bank of England was big. Several other kinds of banks. They began issuing notes, and then eventually those became, in the United States, those became federalized with the Federal Reserve Bank issuing notes, and the nation eventually stopped issuing United States currency and started just issuing Federal Reserve notes at some point, and the Federal Reserve note is the greenback that we trade in today.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been this notion of the thing has value. I believe in the system that backs it up, the United States government, the British government. And so I'll go ahead and trade stuff for this over and over again. I have no compunction about keeping those kind of monies around.
So the thing has value. So those are the main criteria for viability of a currency, a method of payment. It has to have value, either intrinsic gold or extrinsic. It's backed up by someone, right? If it's paper,
right.
if it's paper, it's worth something. If it's backed up by a viable institution or a government.
Right. So with contemporary payment systems, I don't know if you want to hear about this right now, but
yes.
there's kind of a model you can look at with the newer payment systems, all of which remarkably stay, you know, attached to a dollar or a pound or something like that. And so with the electronic payment systems like a PayPal or Vend or some other system that that comes along, Google Wallet, the idea is that when you adopt a technology in general, you think of, is it useful and is it easy to use? And then to add to that, when we talk about transactional types of technical systems, which paper money is a form of, but when we look at transactional systems that are taking place electronically, we also have to trust that the money will be worthwhile, that the institution will be there for a long time, and we also have to believe that there are other people that actually want to use this money. Mm-hmm. So I can have a really cool application that lets me transfer money, but if you're the only person I know that uses it, that's probably not going to take off in the marketplace. Uh-huh. It's got to be, you know, supported by a popular vendor, by a heck of a lot of your friends. These are called network externalities. We have lots of people in a broader network that are also participating in this, and that's what gets it rolling.
Mm-hmm. Are there examples you can call to mind where, I'll call it critical mass, where the sort of a failure to launch, where because of the things that you just mentioned there, they didn't sort of leap over those hurdles?
Well, I think the Johnny come latelys in the electronic payment systems, everybody wanted to get a piece of that. So you've got the Apple Pay, or Apple, whatever it is now, that you're supposed to use your iPhone for, isn't exactly hitting huge. You had Google Wallet, which was Google's attempt to get into that. Google's ubiquitous. They figured that their payment system would do that as well. I think there's one that came out from Android or something like that. The point is, though, that these things didn't really catch on because there really wasn't a need for them. They were, you know, it was nice if you hate PayPal for some reason, you could go to Google Wallet, and there's a lot of sort of adoption because of, you know, disgust with an existing product. But PayPal just really kicked the market in the rear, particularly when they got associated with eBay. eBay needed something that would make it easier to pay for their people's purchases. And then they had the brilliant foresight to buy PayPal, which is the increasingly popular way of paying for these things.
So why does PayPal have a leg up over, you know, paying online with a credit card?
Well, they were early, and for a lot of the transactions that historically were on eBay, you couldn't pay with a credit card. You couldn't pay, you know, the person who was selling the product with a credit card. eBay didn't really want to be in the business of transferring money around. They were, you know, putting sellers and buyers together. And so the PayPal became sort of the first method that you saw in the eBay community of using your credit card or using a bank account to pay somebody far away without having to mail them a check or a certified check or a money order kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so that I think is where they really got their first big moment. And then looking into it further, back when I first started noticing PayPal, they became a popular way for people to pay for just simple things to their friends. If I owe you $100 for the rent this month, rather than have to write a check for it, I can just PayPal it to you, and then you can PayPal it to whoever you owe money to. And it became a set of network externalities that were only large in the sense of eBay, but they were also personal and mini because of the number of people that had PayPal that could transfer money back and forth for relatively trivial things, and mm-hmm. particularly people that don't have a credit card vendor account that can't accept a credit card directly.
When we have the technology enter the picture and we're away from your pebbles and clamshells and gold ingots and coins and so forth, it becomes something we can't see. So there's a trust factor, isn't there, that we trust in technology, be it PayPal or credit cards there. Comment on that, Tony Townsend. Was that a difficult hurdle to overcome?
Well, it's a huge hurdle, and it's bigger even than you may realize. The initial burps in the market occurred when the e-commerce first got started. Maybe 1998, 1999 is when we saw the e-commerce market really starting to roll, and people didn't want to use their credit cards to buy items online. And their thinking was, you know, I can't see the vendor, I can't have my card swiped, I don't know what they're going to do with my number when I'm done with them. And so the banks were just scrambling to come up with some method that people would trust that would allow them to use credit online so that they could keep a hand in the game. A bank I was working with back east in the late 90s, early 2000s, had a team of 200 people working on the problem of getting people to use credit cards online. And so they were doing some strange gymnastics, trying to, I want to buy something from, say, Amazon, and I was supposed to call my bank, get a one-time use credit card number, then use that in the, you know, field at Amazon, and then they would pay off against that credit card number, and I never had to worry about my stuff getting stolen. I mean, imagine what a stifling effect that would have had on electronic commerce.
We use the number once, and then you have to be reissued another random number.
Make another call. You buy three items in a row, and you just stopped between them. Got to go back and get that new number. Mm-hmm. So really, yes. A misstart on their part.
Mm-hmm. So where did we arrive where we feel, obviously, e-commerce has taken off? What was the point at which people gained confidence, and why?
It just came as an enormous surprise, frankly, to the credit card banks. They really didn't see the wave coming where people were going to start using the cards online. I think it was more a function of the attractiveness of the marketplace than it was a deliberate willingness to start using the credit card. It was so easy to buy things online, and pricing structures were so much more attractive than buying things in local specialty stores that I think people just bit it and prayed for the rest.
So they bought things. More and more people bought things online and said, well, I hope nothing bad happens.
Right.
Terry Dooley, this had to enter Shazam's history, too. Talk about the security that Shazam needed. This is a network that transfers money between banks, wherever you may pick up your money at an ATM. Talk about the history of that.
So, you know, from a security perspective, you know, there's a couple of different transactions in the market. You know, as the discussion talks around e-commerce and internet transactions within the physical locations, whether that be an ATM or at a point of sale in a merchant location, networks like Shazam have always authenticated the consumer with a PIN. So that security brings a level of trust both to the merchant and the financial institution that who is performing the transaction is who it's supposed to be. And short of somebody, you know, specifically giving a PIN number to somebody else or somehow overlooking their shoulder or shoulder surfing in some way, that's a very secured transaction and generally sees fraud less than 1% in the market.
Mm-hmm. Was Shazam part of that history, creating the PIN?
Shazam created the first integrated, what we refer to as an integrated point-of-sale system to do a PIN-based transaction in a grocery store. That actually occurred with Dahl's Grocery Store back in 1981. In the state of Iowa, was the first PIN-based transaction anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world?
Anywhere
in
the world.
At Dahl's in Iowa?
It was. And what that created was a standard push by Shazam back then and donated specifications and how we engineered and created the process to be able to settle money, you know, virtually real-time as the transaction occurred. And that has existed throughout its 40 years and is really the standard of debit transactions today.
Mm-hmm. Do we know who decided it was going to be four digits?
I think that is an easy number to remember based off surveys and
okay.
And consumers generally have the ability to remember phone numbers, which is a maximum of seven. That they easily remember a seven-digit phone number. So PIN was a secured number that took more than 999 attempts to break if you were trying to figure out what the PIN was and added, you know, quite a bit more security to that value. So the industry set on four. It can actually be up to 12 digits within the industry, but as a whole, the practice is four digits.
Mm-hmm. Tony Townsend, tell us a little bit about, you mentioned Dahl's supermarket. What about Hy-Vee? Hy-Vee had a type of payment that had a launch failure, didn't it?
Yeah, it's a sad story. Hy-Vee decided that they were going to make life more convenient for their customers, and I'll give them credit. It was a great concept that they were going to use there. It was a fingerprint reader, and you'd sign up for it and go in and register your fingerprint.
What year about was this?
I'm thinking it was about 7, 8, it might have been 10 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you sign up and you get your thumbprint?
Well, it was your forefinger. I thought that was kind of funny, too, but the forefinger apparently is easier to put into a device than your thumb is. So they got they take your fingerprint, and I looked into how secure the fingerprint was, because what scares me about bio-authentication systems is once somebody has my fingerprint, I've only got 9 more to use unless I want to take off my shoes, you know. So there, I was kind of concerned about that. But then it seemed like a good system they used. They were taking just pieces of the fingerprint right there at the site, so they were never holding a full fingerprint. But so the Hy-Vee went to great lengths to tell their customers about this stuff, and we worked with them on a number of installations doing research on the process of installing and talking to customers and stuff like that. It was really fascinating. And so they got this thing rolling, and then the company that was providing the service went out of business. And so I feel terrible for Hy-Vee that they went to all this trouble to get this thing going, and then the company was based in Boston, went up belly up, and they no longer had their fingerprint readers. I don't think it damaged them very much. Most of the people that were playing with it were younger people. I think they realized that technology is tenuous. But it was a kind of a sad day, I think, for the fingerprint reader.
If that company had not gone belly up, were there problems inherent in using a fingerprint? I'm thinking too today. Many smartphones you can unlock with your thumbprint or your fingerprint, right?
Yeah.
Don't people get a little creeped out by that? Like you were intimating.
Yeah. Well, the getting some sort of bio-authenticity that is resistant to having to get a new finger is one of the challenges of the future, but. The same thing with a retinal scan. You've only got 2 eyes and stuff like that. But no, I think it would have taken off really well because I think people are getting used to it. It was just a notion of how many people are using debit cards.
Yeah.
A lot of people continue to use checkbooks for personal, social reasons. A lot of people were worried about the government having their fingerprint from the reader. They were convinced that it was part of the black helicopter movement and everything like that.
But, right. I wonder if we've got to go to a break, but I wonder if there are any people who didn't like it just because they saw that James Bond film where he had the fake fingerprint that he peeled off.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, well, if it's that easy for James Bond, somebody could take my money.
Sure.
Spend it all at Hy-Vee. Tony Townsend, stay with us. Tony Townsend, Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at Iowa State University's College of Business. Also, Terry Dooley is with us, Executive Vice President and Chief Information Officer for Shazam. He's been with the company for quarter century or so, but Shazam has been around since 1976. We're talking this hour about the past, present, and future of paying for things. When we come back, we'll hear about the poor penny. We'll talk with a man who is the national spokesman for eliminating the penny. Wait a minute, I should say retiring the penny. What do you do with your pennies? We'll continue our conversation in just a moment as we talk about how to pay for things with Terry Dooley, Tony Townsend, and coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with Jeff Gore, president and founder of Citizens to Retire the Penny. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, the past, present, and future of money. We're looking at the way in which we pay for things has changed dramatically, especially with the introduction of new technology. This half hour, we want to focus mainly on what is to come in terms of payment. But first, we want to talk a little about what we may be losing, leaving behind. What coinage is the lowliest of them all? The one most of us won't even bother picking off the sidewalk. The coin so low in our esteem it is regularly tossed in the trash. Well, that's the poor penny, of course. Jeff Gore is a physicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's also president and founder of Citizens to Retire the Penny. Jeff Gore, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Jeff, why are you so down on the poor penny?
Well, I can't say that I had any traumatic childhood experiences with the penny, but what I can say is that we as a society should be doing the easy things to make life easier. And from my standpoint, retiring the penny is clearly one of those things.
Okay. Can you give us the reasons?
Certainly. Well, I think first it's just good to remember why it is that we have currency at all, and that's to facilitate cash transactions. You want to be able to go to the corner store and buy something. But the problem is that the penny is just simply no longer worth anything, so it's not useful. And the penny has been our lowest denomination coin for over 150 years now, since the half penny was retired back in the late 1850s. Right? Now, over that time, the penny has just lost much of its value just as a result of inflation. So, for example, if you look at what a penny could buy you in 1940, it's the equivalent of 17 of today's cents. Right? From that standpoint, suggests that not only should we be getting rid of the penny, but maybe the nickel or the dime. You know, it's, mm-hmm. the penny has lost so much of its value, it's very far from being a useful currency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned in the introduction, people really don't use them. They actually throw them away.
That's right. And I think once we're at the stage where a majority of Americans don't want the coin, they won't pick them up, that's a pretty clear indication that we should be doing the simple thing, which is just to go ahead and retire the coin. Mm-hmm. Indeed, this is not something that is a big traumatic thing for the country. It's something that many countries have done, is retired their lowest denomination coin. Indeed, most recently, as many of your listeners may be aware, Canada retired their penny back in 2012. They stopped making the coin, and I don't think you've heard any of any problems. I certainly haven't.
Mm-hmm. But there is opposition in this country against retiring the penny. What are their arguments? What are the best arguments that you've heard that you have to counter?
Right. Well, the best arguments, I think that it's always good to look to see who's supporting these movements. And in this case, it's largely the companies that are supplying the blanks to make the penny. So, of course, it's in their interest that we continue to use and make the coin. You know, and of course, there are many, many arguments that you'll hear, and none of them really hold any water.
Well, right? I think if I can throw one in, I think that I've read is that eliminating the penny would spur inflation, because companies would round up the prices to the nearest nickel. Wouldn't that be true?
Right. So the way that we would work, the way we would do this is we would indeed round to the nearest nickel. It's important to note that rounding is a process that half the time it goes up and half the time it goes down. And indeed, we are already rounding. The way that prices work today is that when you go to the store and you buy something, you add sales tax. The final amount doesn't land right on the penny mark, but instead, what we do is we round to the nearest penny. And indeed, half the time it goes up, half the time it goes down. I checked recently when I bought a coffee at Starbucks, and indeed, they had rounded down to the nearest penny. All right, so if any of your listeners are worried that Starbucks is stealing our money through this rounding process, the rounding is something we already do today, and it's just something that we would continue to do. Just we would round to the nearest nickel instead of the nearest penny, so it would neither increase nor decrease prices.
A number of years ago, you were on the Colbert Report. You endorsed Barack Obama's 2008 presidential bid. It was quite a few years ago you were on this, because then Senator Obama said he would consider eliminating the penny. Now, President Obama has been in office nearly 8 years. Has he made any effort to do so?
So he has been a bit of a disappointment in this regard, I will say. He, as a candidate, was the only candidate that had expressed an interest in reforming our currency and retiring the penny, despite the fact that he comes from Illinois, and so you might be concerned that he would be biased in favor of the penny with Lincoln. Mm-hmm. But he has indeed made some further supportive comments. The problem is that it's just like many of these, it's not the most important issue in the world. There are other things that indeed if I could choose between, you know, solving world hunger and getting rid of the penny, you know, I would go for the hunger.
Right. Is this a partisan issue at all?
No, it's not. You know, and I think just because President Obama has made supportive comments about retiring the penny, that was not a continuation of any sort of alignment with the Democratic Party. I think this is an issue that really both, you know, fiscal conservatives and others should be able to get behind, because it really is an example of something where the government is spending over $100 million a year to make these coins that nobody wants. Mm-hmm. And I think that stopping this sort of things that I think broadly we can agree it's wasteful government spending. I think that this is something that we should all be able to agree on.
Mm-hmm. When do you forecast that the penny will be phased out?
Well, I'm hopeful, actually. Perhaps one of the most exciting recent developments from the standpoint of us anti-penny advocates is that for the last 10 years now, the U.S. Mint has acknowledged that they are spending more than a penny to make a penny. I think that for many years, Americans maybe acknowledged that the penny wasn't a worthwhile coin, but there was a little bit of a feeling that it was also just not worth our effort to get rid of. But when people think about the idea that it costs more money to make the money than the money is worth, then it really highlights kind of the silliness of the situation that we're in.
Mm-hmm. In our world where we have ever more access to digital money, I wonder, and you referenced this earlier, is getting rid of the penny just the beginning? Will, for instance, our children be telling quaint stories to their children about how they used to actually physically give people coins and bills as payment, and it would be considered as quaint and old-fashioned as that bottle of fresh milk on your doorstep?
Well, it's certainly possible, but I think that it's important to remember that it's been 20 years now that we've been talking about the digital monetary economy and how cash was going away. And frankly, if you look at the number of cash transactions that are taking place in the United States per year, this has not been dropping in the way that you might have thought based on a lot of the hype that happened in the 90s. So while I certainly think that we should be thinking about how our monetary system is going to change, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't fix the problems that are clearly here today.
Mm. Okay. Before we say goodbye, I really have to tug at your heartstrings. One more attempt here. Don't you have any sentimental attachment to this coin? A penny for your thoughts. A penny saved is a penny earned. It's part of our culture. Are you so heartless as to really end this interview by saying, I would like to get rid of it tomorrow?
Well, I should say that, when I was first thinking about starting this group advocating that we get rid of the penny, I was going to call it Citizens to Eliminate the Penny. But indeed, this struck some people as being too heartless. And so we decided that Citizens to Retire the Penny was more appropriate, because it's highlighting that the penny has served a really valuable purpose
right.
for hundreds of years in our country. But it's time to let the penny go and let it let it get the retirement that it deserves.
Put it on a pedestal, frame it, and put it in a place of high esteem and recognize it as our past.
Exactly.
Okay. Jeff Gore, physics professor at MIT, president and founder of Citizens to Retire the Penny. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Don't run under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you and me.
You've just joined us. We're talking about the past, present, and future of paying for things. Joining us still for the rest of the hour, they have been with us the entire hour. Terry Dooley is the Executive Vice President and Chief Information Officer for Shazam. Shazam is 40 years old. It came at a time and heralded in a time when we can get cash anytime, anywhere from ATMs. Also, Tony Townsend of Iowa State University with us, Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at ISU's College of Business. Let's get back to what's to come. Tony Townsend, I'd like to have you comment after hearing that discussion of the extinction, the retirement of the penny. How do you react to rumors, efforts to put the penny on the extinct list?
Oh, it's an unusual topic. I mean, there have been people talking about it since I can remember. But the problem is, if you retire the penny, you could possibly make it less available or something and round things up. You still have to have it because pennies are important. I mean, one of the things that Terry told you was that Shazam makes pennies on a transaction, and those pennies add up to considerable amounts of money over time. A lot of embezzlers, corporate embezzlers, figured out ways to strip just a penny or two off of transactions. And when the transactions add up over time, there are thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars that they're able to steal from the company. So the penny value is actually important, and it keeps our system from having to round up, which I tend to agree with the economists, I think would be inflationary. But in the digital world, a penny is no different from a $10 bill. It's just another number that's got to be stored and transacted.
Okay, so we just get rid of this pesky thing that we carry around in our pockets or leave in the dashboard.
Yeah, I guess.
Or on the sidewalk.
My fear is that if you get rid of the physical representation, then what does the digital value mean? Does that mean we have to transfer into our digital methods of moving money around that rounding up process?
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about the future here, electronic payments. Tony, what's out there? What is the future? We've talked about several payment methods, PayPal, Venmo, Google Wallet, Apple Pay. Of course, we still have credit cards around. Where is this heading? What do you see? Where do you see the strengths going forward?
I think we're going to continue to see developments around the edges of the fundamental sort of structural methods of paying. You've got, you know, cash accounts that people can access. E-checking has become a lot more popular than it ever was, particularly with online banking applications. And then the credit cards that essentially do the same sort of thing but also have a lending component to them. And both of these methods are tremendously popular, and they provide a foundation for everything else that comes along. So with those structural foundations that are pretty much forever intact, they almost have to be, it's just a question of how we're going to move that money to different people. The PayPal, there's like one called Vend POS today. They're all just different methods of moving money from, you know, a traditional structured institution to somebody to give them the value, again, at a traditional structured institution. Mm-hmm. Guessing the future is tough. I mean, the Shazam folks are really, really brilliant because they saw a need in the future, came up with an app for it, and bang, there it was. It's really difficult to come up with something that is going to be the next big thing. There has to be a need for the next big thing, and there has to be some reason that people will move to it. And the question is, in the current marketplace, where do these things come from? I mean, there were, God help you if you ever used it, but the Second Life, you know, there were Second Life dollars. My son wants money to convert into, was it Rust dollars or something, so he can buy new character components. There's little transactional systems that are, you know, sort of idiosyncratic to a variety of different parts of people's lives, but they don't spread into the general economy. They thought the Second Life thing was going to, but it didn't take off. Mm-hmm. And so I think that people are leery about new things. They enjoy them, but they remain leery when it means tapping their personal resources. The biggest thing that came along, I think, that made credit popular going online as well, was that the banks took a lot of trouble, made a lot of trouble to assure you that if somebody stole your credit card number, you weren't going to have to pay for it.
Right.
And as long as that's there, that's pretty sweet dealing. Money can't do that.
But our credit cards have changed, though, haven't they? We now have computer chips in our cards. Why?
Well, that's to ensure the transaction that where you're physically with the card are working. There have been a number of attempts to try to blend the computer chip technology or fingerprints and stuff like that into online transactions, but they haven't really taken off. I think there's that. It goes back to that model. Something has to be useful. It has to be easy to use, and the easy to use doesn't really, you know, kick in when I've got to do a whole bunch of tricks with my payment system.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are resistant to that kind of thing, and so they just haven't. Those additional security things, which are very important, have not really taken off.
Terry Dooley, what's next for Shazam? It was the next big thing, 1976, really brilliant, revolutionary. What's the future?
Well, I think the future, you know, is how do you enable more channels to leverage the infrastructure that exists within, you know, the overall payments industry. So for Shazam, whether a transaction starts at an ATM, whether it starts on a mobile phone, at a PC, on a website, or in a grocery store, or, you know, an Amazon website, it doesn't really matter. The transaction is the same once it enters the digital form.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the previous conversation about retiring the penny, there's business transactions that occur where folks are charged tenths or hundredths of a penny, you know, for that service. So not only do we do business at a 1 cent level, we do business, you know, all the way down to hundreds, if not farther, on some products and services out in the overall business world. So when you start to look at that, it really, you know, looks pretty significant just to retire something.
Right.
But for the future, you know, mobile wallets, for example, the Apple Pays, the Samsung Pays, the Android Pays, those are just new channels that are driving transactions into the ecosystem. The digital version of that transaction is almost identical to what we see today. You mentioned the chip on the card. You know, the chip technology was really geared to try to eliminate the ability to counterfeit a card if someone was to heist your card number, your expiration date of that card number. And those chips did a lot to counter counterfeit cards, but it didn't address fraud as we know it on the internet. And with Apple Pay and solutions like that, you have biometrics now being used. And the professor made some interesting points earlier on that. One of those challenges with biometrics is with a PIN-based transaction, the financial institution is actually making that verification decision and saying yes or no. With biometrics, they're assuming that the person on the phone is the right person, and that may not always be the case. So you still have a good opportunity for fraud there. But the future is really how do we enable transactions just as we know it today, whether that be signing on to an application and saying, hey, I'm going to be at a Shazam ATM machine on this corner on this block. I need to be able to walk up and scan my phone or enter a code and have money distributed without having to use my card. Or can I initiate that with my phone or schedule that to occur when, you know, I come around the corner? So there's lots of things that are enabling much more convenience for the consumer. The problem with some of these solutions is it starts to drive consistency out. And one of the reasons cash continues to be used, checks continue to be used, cards continue to be used, and you don't see this rampant takeoff of some of these other solutions is because the consistency is lost.
Will we ever have a cashless society, Terry?
I think the technology exists to enable that, but I don't think you'll see that for many, many decades.
Tony, do you agree?
I don't see cashless. People want to buy things that they don't want linked back to them.
Exactly,
and if nothing
right.
else, just buying embarrassing stuff, requires cash.
Okay, so get out there, way, way out there in the future. Jean-Luc Picard, way out there in the final 2 minutes. Where are we going to be in I don't know, 30, 40, 50, 100 years, Tony, can you imagine? Will we carry anything? Will we just walk into a store and something will recognize who we are and dock our account? Or I don't know.
Well, you're scaring me, but I think it's probably going to be something like that. You know, there'll be either an implantable chip or face recognition or something like that, and I'll just say charge it to my account, and it'll be just like it used to be at the little dry goods store down the street from me where, you know, Walt would just punch it in, write a slip up, and bill us at the end of the month. You know, it'll be that kind
of
thing.
Well, that's an interesting sort of coming back around to a folksy beginning where if you could call that kind of technology folksy. Terry, what are your observations way off in the future?
I would agree with that. I think the ability to have something embedded or be part of any wearable item that you have and be able to program that as you switch devices is going to be a reality. I think one of the challenges with that, and I think we're going to begin to see some of this over the next 5-10 years, is to enable that, the consumer has to really just give up all of their information. And to the point of anonymous transactions, there's still going to be the need for that. So, you know, as you go all digital, how do you do it anonymously?
Right. And will hackers and counterfeiters will be by our side lurking the whole way, right, Tony?
Absolutely. It's what life is all about, stealing other people's money. But, you know, it's kind of a terrifying and yet, you know, it's going to happen at some point. So,
Okay, very good. Do you have any specific research in this area, Tony? We have a few seconds here that you're especially looking into.
No, we've studied some trust issues and stuff like that. I mean, most of my work is just how people operate with the medium itself, not with the cash part of it. We assume the cash part. But it's really an interesting problem. The research we did with the fingerprint reader opened up my eyes to an awful lot of undercurrent of people's income level and stuff like that and their ability to benefit from these new systems. Poor people can't get into these things as fast as more well-to-do people can. And that's sort of
there's a whole other conversation about the dividing class in these systems of payment.
It's big.
Tony Townsend, thank you very much. Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at Iowa State University's College of Business. And Terry Dooley, Executive Vice President and Chief Information Officer for Shazam. Thanks for coming into our studios, guys.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Gray Lanta today. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Hope you tune in tomorrow for News Buzz when we'll have a look back at the anniversary of 9/11.